agenda. In order to finish today, we have four public hearings, all of which will be quite lengthy if we don't move ahead. So we're going to do Senate. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 541.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 541 creates the Task Force on Improving Mental Health Services. It specifies the membership of that task force and directs the task force to study and make recommendations on actions that can be taken to improve the delivery of mental health and alcohol and drug treatment services. The task force sunsets on December 31st of 2005, and there's an emergency declared, and the bill would be effective on passage. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and in your packet you do have written testimony from Dolores Hubert from the Governor's Commission on Senior Services.
Okay. Gina Furman, Kevin Campbell, and Bart Murray. Gina, would you like to start?
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee member, I want to talk a little bit about why the Association of Oregon Counties mental health programs ask for this task force bill. We were talking to Senator Winters, and we were very concerned with the very, very serious cuts to mental health the Oregonians with mental health and mental illness issues. We were very concerned that with these cuts that nothing would be done in the interim. And so Senator Winters asked us to come up with some language that would help us form a task force to take a look at what we could do in the interim as far as supporting a mental health system between the state and the counties. And so that was the purpose for this bill. Now, I would also tell you that in the meantime, there is a Senate Bill 146 that I understand Senator Minnis has proposed some amendments that are still being written. We have talked to DHS, Bob Nickel, and Madeline Olson, and also the governor's office, Aaron. And there's another, it's a commission bill, Senate 146, and they think that we could perhaps, with one more day of talking to each other, come up with something that might be appropriate and combine both these bills.
Okay. I'll open a full committee public hearing. Questions?
I would also add, Senator, that what Bart and Kevin are going to talk about is the things that we're concerned about, that we want to make sure that whatever discussions we have, Senate Bill 146 at this time does not have legislative representation on it, and Senate Bill 541 that we're hearing today, we think it's very important that there's legislative representation on the bill. And we also want to make sure that the work that was done in the Mental Health Alignment Work Group 2 years ago. There was a lot of work done. 50 people sat in the room every month for a year. We want to make sure that report goes forward and that we act on it.
Okay. I do have a question, and that is, before we spend a lot of time on this bill, this is one that Senator Winters would welcome in her subcommittee on Ways and Means, if we refer this. Because otherwise, you know, I don't know that we would refer it unless Ways and Means tells us to.
Senator Winters, I just spoke with her a couple minutes ago, and she asked me to testify for her, which is a little bit hard to do. And she actually said that she welcomes this bill and wants more discussion.
Okay. We will take it seriously then.
Great.
Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon, Senator, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell, and I'm here today representing the Eastern Oregon Human Services Consortium. For the past 8 years, I've worked with the consortium, which our task is to coordinate the mental health programs of 13 of Eastern Oregon's counties. We represent the most rural part of the state. We cover about 46,000 square miles, and we have a combined population of about 220,000 people. delivering mental health services or integrated behavioral health services in Eastern Oregon is a very, very difficult situation, even under the best of times. And this past 2 years has really hit us very hard. We believe that every time 40 cents has been cut in Salem for lack of revenue, we've lost, in most cases, a dollar's worth of ability to deliver services out in our communities. Our population is proportionally poorer than the statewide average. We have higher unemployment than the statewide average. And we have disproportionate degrees of high-risk populations because of placement of state hospitals and large group homes. Over this past year, we conducted a regional 3024 plan in concurrence with House Bill 3024 that was passed by the legislature. We had money to plan. There is no money for implementation, but we're very proud of the plan that we put together. What we found in that plan is there are existing resources at the local level that could be leveraged possibly to salvage Medicaid match. We've also found an interest that prior to now we weren't really certain existed among county commissioners to make human services a priority. When I was a county judge in Grant County, I was as guilty as any other county commissioner of having a higher priority on transportation than mental health. And one of the reasons was I could understand transportation. I knew who the players were, and we worked together here in Salem. Everybody will tell you that the current system is extremely complex and very difficult to understand. And our goal is to have legislative involvement so that we can come back in 2 years through a task force mechanism and make some meaningful substantive suggestions as to how the system can work better. And in 541, you may think there's a bit of a disproportionate balance for folks from Eastern Oregon, all of whom, by the way, are willing to come on our own dime, and for folks from Western Oregon. But we really think that there's some ingenuity out there in the way that we have done business in the past and how we're committed to doing business in the future that really could provide a better system of care for Oregon's most vulnerable folks. So the two pieces that I would want to leave with you today that are essential in this task force: legislative involvement, because it's a very complex issue and needs to go probably more than simply one session to address the long-term systemic fixes necessary, and integration of behavioral health so that we can talk about both alcohol and drug and mental health in a seamless sort of a system, not be in the silo mentality that we found ourselves in a couple years ago. We think this is a natural transition. We think it deserves legislative oversight. We believe that the fiscal impact is minimal and the dividends would be optimal over the long run.
Thank you. You mentioned something about local resources. Would you go back to that again? I caught the word, but I was doing something else at the time.
Certainly. In our 3024 plan, Senator Morissette, in our 3024 plan, we identified approximately $2 million of resources that we believe are currently available for local match for Medicaid funding if there was a streamlined mechanism in place to expose them to that match. Now, that is easier said than done. There are a number of issues that need to be resolved, such as statewideness and definitions of targeted case management. But we feel with some time to work on it and a bit of education as to how the mechanism can work, even we could understand the system.
Okay. Thank you. Bart Murray.
Senator, I'm Bart Murray. I'm a director of the Alcohol and Drug Treatment Program in Baker City, Oregon, New Directions Northwest. And the reason I'm interested in this bill is that we have a lot of clients that come into our treatment program that have both mental health and alcohol and drug problems. And I'm very interested in any way that we can improve the coordination of services for these people. And part of the difficulty at times is that because the funding flows into different funding streams into different areas, it's hard at times to get the services that these people need. And without having both of those services, their chances of being able to be successful after treatment is fairly slim. A person needs treatment both for the alcohol and drug issues, but they also need treatment for any kind of mental health issues. So that's the one piece that we're very interested in, any way to try to coordinate that effort. And we see being able to do that on a regional basis as being an important way to do that. Eastern Oregon, we're sort of unique in that the 13 counties, we've worked together for over 25 years as a group of people. We have a long history of working together, and I think have the ability to try to do the most that we can with what we have. The other area that's very important is if there's any way for us to use local general dollars to help match Title 19, because I'm telling some of you already know, but the state doesn't have the dollars to do that. We've had terrific cuts in alcohol and drug, and also cuts in mental health. And if there's any way that we can buy back some of those cuts by using local money that's already there without having to take additional dollars from the state, I think that's worth really looking at. And I know that other states do that. So I know if the other states can do it, that we can do it. So I hope that we look at that and try to figure out if there's a way we can make those monies available. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Before you leave, Gina, I think I heard what you say earlier is that Senate Bill 146, which we've already heard, you're talking about some amendments that might blend these bills, or we would take care of it in one or the other? Is that what you're
saying? I understand from the governor's office, Senator Morissette, and from Senator Winters, is that if we have a conversation, a few of us in the room, and have one more discussion, we can probably decide where things best fit and what bill to amend.
Okay.
To get to what we need.
Good.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I had a conversation yesterday evening in the governor's office, Senate reception.
You met with the governor yesterday.
Well, I did say hi to him, but actually, more importantly, I talked to Aaron Kelly Seal regarding this very issue, and Gina's right. There appears to be some movement within DHS.
Good.
And it looks like they're going down the right direction to meld these two ideas, so it's very
great.
Positive.
Good. Senator Walker.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have this letter here, as all of us should, from Dolores Hubert of Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I think she raises some important questions that really haven't been addressed.
I don't see that.
And if I might just start asking these questions.
If you want to raise those, go ahead.
I'll ask the members of the panel. Ms. Hubert is concerned that this duplicates work that has already been done by the Governor's Mental Health Alliance Task Force that Governor Kitzhaber put together in January of 2000. She also believes that DHS has an advisory council on mental health issues, and they are providing direction and advice to the department about the needs of people in our communities. And so she thinks this is duplicative, that we don't need another task force. I think they're valid questions, and so I'd encourage any of the three of you to respond about those concerns.
Yes. Senator Morissette, Senator Walker, those are very good questions, and I would describe it this way. Our purpose was not to duplicate the work that was done in the Mental Health Alignment Work Group Task Force. In fact, our purpose was to not let that sit on our on the shelf, and that is our exact question is we have all this work that has been done, and it's sitting there, and in fact, we're going backwards, not forwards. And so we wanted a task force that could grab the bull by the horns and take this work and decide next steps. Now, it is true we have a management planning group that give direction, looks at federal block grants, but we believe that currently their purpose is a little bit shorter than we'd like to see. We have a system now that has been gutted, and our most vulnerable citizens need our help, the state and county system together. And so we don't believe that the current planning group goes far enough in improving the mental health system. And so that's what we're interested in, and in making sure that rolls in, and we don't think it's there right now.
And then if I might, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that answer, because, I mean, clearly we on this committee have heard a great deal about mental health needs in this state, as well as you have. I have worked on youth suicide prevention for many years, and this state frankly sucks at, you know, if I can say it in the vernacular, at delivery of those services to rural communities. We have made great strides with our youth suicide prevention coordinator, but we've given him no tools to work with, absolutely none, no financial work. So in that respect, I agree that this task force stuff that's been done before with Governor Kitzhaber shouldn't be sitting on the shelf. But the other question that she raises, and I'll address that, and I don't know if it's in either of those two bills, is that she wants a representative of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services to be part of that task force. And has that been addressed?
Senator Morissette, Senator Walker, that would be no problem. I think the two groups from Senate Bill 146 and 541 can get together, and we don't see a problem with that. I think Kevin Campbell would like to address a little bit.
Very briefly, Senator Morissette, Senator Walker, our 3024 plan that we created at the regional level, and as far as I know, we were the only region to take on such an effort, was a direct result of the Mohawk Work Group. And in spite of the fact that there's no additional money at the end of the rainbow, we saw it prudent to plan as a region. And the bottom line of our plan is that we need to better integrate county services and state-delivered services and have accountable delivery systems within each of our 13 counties rather than have the multitude of disjointed services and payment systems that our very few citizens have been exposed to over the last 10 to 15 years.
Great.
Thank you. Gina, I remember the frustration that you had at the end of last session concerning the implementation of the plan and no money to do it. And so I totally understand why you want to come back and try to implement the plan. So, okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 541 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 669. Don Wentz, would you come up, please? If you're here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 669 directs the Public Employees Benefit Board to establish the Employee Welfare Benefit Plan. It specifies that the plan must provide members of the Voluntary Employees Beneficiary Associations with individual health care expense trust accounts to pay for qualified health care expenses of the members and dependents of the members. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and you'll see that the legislative fiscal analysis is attached.
Would you introduce yourself, please?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Don Wentz for the Association of Engineering Employees, 1761 Liberty Street, Southeast, Salem, Oregon, 97302. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 669. I have a short but informative PowerPoint presentation for you today. Please sit back and relax to my calm waters and heavenly sky motif. There's a healthcare crisis in America today. Most people are somewhat apathetic about socioeconomic issues until they hit home. About a year and a half ago, the healthcare crisis came knocking at my door. I found out that one of my friends quit taking his heart medication because he couldn't afford it. It was $500 a month. Is that an isolated incident, or is that an example of something more systemic in the system? Well, today in Oregon, there is a health insurance dilemma. We have, according to latest statistics, 890,000 Oregonians under without any health insurance. That translates into 28.7% of the people under 65 who qualify for Medicare. Almost over one in four Oregonians are without health insurance. What that does is creates escalating health insurance costs. Over 40 million Americans are uninsured. 37% of workers who lose their jobs also lose their health insurance coverage. That's an important point with a downturn in the economy and Oregon leading the nation in unemployment. 2 million Americans lost their jobs in 2001. Premiums for employer-sponsored coverages increased 11%. 8 in 10 uninsured Americans are working families who just cannot afford insurance. People are struggling to try to cope with the health care crisis. They make tough decisions every day to buy baby formula or to buy prescription medicine, to pay the rent or to purchase health insurance. What happens when they can't afford health insurance and get a serious medical condition? They no longer can pay, and the institutions are forced to sustain a unreimbursable expense. If something major happens, then we get lawyers into our doctor's offices and hospital rooms. The number one reason for personal bankruptcies in America is the inability to pay for medical expenses. That is the citizen side. The employer side here in Oregon, from PEB, we have escalating employer costs. From 1998, it was $386 the employers paid for health insurance. In 2003, it escalated to $641, almost doubled in 5 years. So what can we do to help curb the health care crisis? We have introduced Senate Bill 669, which is a VBA plan. It directs PEB to create a VBA plan and requires the employer use unused vacation and sick leave benefits to fund the plan, and it provides limits for the members and rules to create the plan. So what is a VBA? A VBA is a voluntary employee beneficiary association created under 501(c)(9), which is a tax-exempt status from the IRS. It provides for the sickness, accident, and other benefits to the participants. VBA is in a trust, and joining a multiple employer VBA, there's advantages of a pre-approved plan from the IRS and cost reduction. Under which rules do they operate? VBAs are employee welfare plans through tax-exempt trusts, and they comply with state and federal laws. Also, government entities, corporations, unions establish them. How to adopt a VBA? To adopt a VBA, the employer establishes tax-exempt trust. The contributions are allocated in individual accounts, and it's through, just like a 401k plan, the trust grows and statements are issued. Implementation cost. There's a letter of determination, cost about $1,500, initial setup, about $12,500, and an annual trust renewal of $2,500. Those costs vary somewhat. There's packages from the industry. This is a nationwide VBA plan that can be brought off the shelf instead of creating a new plan individual for the state. Is the VEBA the same as an MSA? No. MSAs are under a different statute of IRS. That's under 220. MSAs are different in that they are created for small businesses that have 50 employers or less. VEBA advantages. A VEBA has three types of plans rolled into one. Like an MSA, it rewards healthy individuals by tax-deferred accumulations. Like a 401, it allows employers to control investments. And like flexible spending accounts, it pays, reimburses 213D medical expenses with tax-free dollars. Advantages of multiple VEBAs. Employers participating in 10 or more VEBAs qualify under 419A F6 exemption, which is a statute that's recently been changed to give better tax status to employers to deduct other expenses other than stated in 419. A VEBAs included medical expenses, post-retirement expenses, death benefits, post-retirement benefits, disability benefits. VEBA is a tax-exempt trust, and it works to provide maximum tax advantages. The tax advantage for the employer is they will not pay the FICA tax 7.65%, so $1,000, $76.50 saved to the employer. Likewise, the benefits have value for unused sick leave. $1,000, if it was not used and paid directly through a VEBA, would only be worth something like $643 to the employee after taxes. That's assuming a 28% federal income tax and a 7.65% FICA tax. Tax avoidance. This is the most powerful point of a VEBA, because a VEBA has the exempt trust the money goes into, and when a person accesses that money, they will have tax avoidance from federal taxes that they don't have to pay when they go out and purchase health insurance premiums, Medicare Part B, qualified long-term care. No one, very seldom, plans for long-term care expenses, but that is a very good feature that many people have a need for later in life, and prescription drugs. So PEBS' mission, we have this under PEBS' umbrella, is to provide a high quality and other benefits at state cost affordable to employees in the states. This is not just a vision for PEB. It is a true mission under statute 243.15 that gives them clear directions. Now I would like to address the fiscal. What we have is a fiscal statement that was put together that gave a Senate Bill 669 estimated cost. The fiscal was put together with some assumptions, and the assumptions that created the fiscal created a number for an annual cost simply by multiplying an annual rate, the number of FTEs, the sick leave and the vacation hours, because we are using unused benefits, and came up with the total hours and multiplied that number to give an annual cost. That annual cost truly represents the cash conversion value of using those unused benefits. this is how the plan works. This is how the plan's funded, through unused benefits that are already on the books. That does not represent the cost nor the savings of the bill. I will highlight here my embellishment of the fiscal impact. What this shows, by calculating the savings of the FICA tax that the employer would be exempt from paying, shows that that cash value increases in the first biennium values of $18.5 million and $7.4 million. So the best case scenario for this bill, if it's adopted, just like the fiscal analysis, I'm not challenging how they calculated the numbers. What I'm saying is, this is theoretically scenario, best case savings to the state that can be realized from adopting this plan.
Mr.
Yes. Senator Menes.
As you can see, Don, I'm a co-sponsor of your bill here, and I actually like the idea of the Aviva, but I too am concerned about fiscal impact, because I think there are some assumptions about how sick time and vacation time might accrue for particularly employers in the public sector who are members of PERS. Because if I understand correctly, there is not necessarily a cash account set aside for each employee that could then be converted over into the VEBA account, per se. There's an assumption that rolls into the accumulation of sick time, and then they pay out a cash stipend when someone's actually sick. But the way the PERS system works is when you retire, your sick leave accumulated becomes part of your base for the calculation for your retirement pension. So there's not a cash sum setting aside in PERS or anywhere else, as far as I understand, that could just simply be rolled over into VEBA. But let me kind of go on to where I think there might be some merit here, because Senator Corcoran, who chairs the General Government Committee, and I have had some discussions about this. If the VEBA plan, which I think is a great idea, I think it has merit for a couple of reasons. You get an entire union organization, for instance, that would have to, at least a majority of a particular bargaining unit, would have to vote to accept the VEBA, which buys them that gap insurance, basically, between retirement and Medicare eligibility. Mm-hmm. But the question here is, how do you make that work financially? And the difficulty is, with PERS, you have an accumulated benefit, albeit maybe a phantom cash benefit, but the employers would literally be paying twice under the current scheme in the bill. So what I'm going to suggest is that maybe we look at some other alternate schemes, because as we look at reorganizing the public employee retirement system, that VEBA maybe become an option, but perhaps we use a portion of the retirement payout at retirement as opposed to sick leave. What I don't know is whether federal tax law would allow that kind of thing. In other words, what I'm saying is that many of the members of different bargaining units may buy into a VEBA plan because it buys them a great benefit. The union would have to participate in agreeing to do that, but there has to be a place where the cash comes from, and the best place, I think, comes from that cash that might be given to the retiree upon retirement from the public employee retirement system. Hopefully I'm making sense. I don't know.
Chair, Senator Menes, thank you for that question. And I have
a long question, a dissertation, political dissertation.
I likewise have heard some of that discussion. And there are two mechanisms by which a VEBA plan can be funded. One is by the use of unused benefits. And the other is by contributions. As in our cover letter of our presentation, we believe, as well as you do, Senator, that VEBAs have a great value to both the employee and the employer. They're very popular, 10,000 across the United States. Many major companies have VEBAs. Here's the statement from Boeing that says in year 2001, they paid out in insurance premiums $250,000, and that resembles the value that is shown on the spreadsheet from FISCA. So I agree with you wholeheartedly, Senator. BEBAs, I believe, have the right time and the right place, and we can find a way to make it fit state government. There are many states that have EBA plans today.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, I'm actually in one through the Portland Police Association, so I'm familiar with it. But in our issue is we did accrue a cash account for sick time that was paid out on a pro rata basis, depending on your tenure in the agency, that rolls into the VEBA account. I think it's dissimilar to the PERS situation. But I guess what I'm saying is that if you did opt into a VEBA account for a union organization, SEIU or whomever, there would have to be an offsetting reduction in pension benefit, because the employers are really would under the VEBA. If you did the VEBA plan and you didn't do the offset, you'd have a double hit for the benefit. You'd basically be being accruing a benefit you didn't earn. If that makes any sense.
Chair, Senator Minnis, to the bill, Section 5, Article 6, tries to address that issue, that any sick leave converted to employer contributions under the section may not be used by the member to increase retirement allowance under ORS 238-350. We've tried to address that, and I'll honestly with you, we are trying to run as fast as we can to separate ourselves from the PERS issue, and you can understand the reason because of that.
So, Mr. Chairman, I actually think they're connected very well.
Okay. Well, that and they may very well be. To the question about transferring pension funds to VEBA funds, I don't believe the federal government is going to look favorably upon that. It's hard to cross boundaries between those type of plans.
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't you be able to do it if the entire union voted in favor of it?
That is
because it's a contract law issue.
Chair Senator Minnis, it may be possible to do that. I would think maybe from one union's bargaining standpoint, what the bill was trying to address was a statewide VEBA plan, so it would be much more difficult in that aspect. But I would think one would have to precede the other, because this is a conversion of benefits,
right.
and once the VEBA becomes into existence, and that's the chicken, the egg, cart, and the horse routine, right. One has to have the other preceding before the conversion can be attempted.
But Mr. Chairman, I think you've got some contract law issues here. That if you have a statewide VEBA account and you're assuming that everybody rolls into it at some point, or each individual member suddenly becomes a member of the VEBA, I think you're going to end up having some contract law issues. I don't think that the legislature could enact a VEBA and members would just individually jump into it.
Chair, Senator Minnis, that is indeed correct, and that is part of the bill, because once the state plan would be enacted by PEB, then it would be by voluntary participation of their represented organization, whether or not they wanted to participate in that plan, start a different plan, or not participate at all.
All right. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Thanks, Gina. Okay. Malia Christensen? And Steve Morton, would you come up also? I,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mylia Christensen. I'm the administrator of the Public Employees Benefit Board. Thank you for including my comments. I'll be very brief. I know you have an ambitious schedule. I was just going to update you about some of the discussions that the Public Employees Benefit Board has had, as well as just a brief background. As most of you know, PEB's authority is to design, negotiate, and administer benefits for state employees and their family members. In creating PEB, the legislature asked PEB to provide high-quality benefits at a cost that's affordable both to the state and to employees. We provide services to 46,000 employees, about 58,000 family members, and we currently cover about 3,000 retirees who are not yet eligible for Medicare. When they become eligible for Medicare, they need to leave the PEB program currently, and about 600 COBRA participants. Each year, the board goes through a very comprehensive planning process. We're in the middle of that process now. It takes about 6 months to plan the benefits for the coming year. In this case, the board is currently very busy with plans for 2004. The board receives a tremendous amount of feedback from agencies, employees, other suggestions, takes that into consideration in their planning, and it has done quite a bit for retirees, including most recently mutualizing the increases across our plans so that retirees don't take a large increase on the retiree program as they would have if they were separately rated. And we've also offered a special plan for retirees that provides quality benefits, but at a cost that's less than that for full-time employees. The board has some ambitious options for 2007 and is planning for those as well. Mr. Wentz contacted PEB and asked if he could share with the board the ideas and concepts behind his VIBA program. And on March 4th, he presented the same PowerPoint presentation you've just heard to members of the board who were also considering other tax advantage plans for state employees at the same time, so it worked very nicely. The board asked the staff and consultants to go back and do some more research, which we did, and that's been highlighted on the testimony. Many of the points have been covered already by Mr. Wentz's presentation, including what a VIBA is, how is a VIBA funded. One piece that just came up in the questions that I would like to clarify, it's our understanding that the employer membership in the association is voluntary. However, if the majority of any defined group of employees votes to participate, then all members of that group must participate. So in the case of the state, it could be a collective bargaining group, it could be an agency, it could be an unrepresented group, a division or a department. Once the majority votes, then all of the employees of that group are required to participate. And I would agree, I think there are other collective bargaining issues, and I'm not an expert on that, but I would agree with some of the previous comments. Finally, I would just note that the bill appears to include a much broader group than state employees. PEB currently has the authority to provide services for state employees very explicitly by statute, but not other public entities that seem to be covered by the bill. In conclusion, the Plan Design Committee and the full board reviewed the research on the tax advantage plans, including the VIBA concept, and as I mentioned earlier, they have already a pretty ambitious plan. The board was very appreciative of Mr. Wentz's efforts, but ultimately voted to remain neutral on the bill. They also noted a significant concern about the potential fiscal impact, not to PEB, which is relatively small, but rather the larger statewide issue that was discussed earlier about the funding of the sick leave to convert over to the VIBA. And that concludes my formal comments, but I'd be delighted to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today and talk about the creating a statewide VIBA program. I'm Steve Manton with the City of Portland Office of Management and Finance. The city opposes this bill. It would create a new cost to governments already overburdened with retirement costs from the public employees' retirement system. This bill would allow employees to convert unused sick leave into cash payment into a VIBA account set up by the Public Employees Benefit Board. Currently, PERS employees can use accumulated sick leave to increase their final average salary if they retire under the full formula benefit. The cost of this addition to the final average salary has been computed system-wide by the actuary and is part of the total cost of the system, so an employer does not bear an additional cost at retirement. If an employee retires under the money match benefit, the employee receives no benefit from the sick leave, and the employer gets to reduce their liability by removing sick leave balance from the books.
This bill would encourage employees, particularly those in the short term, say the next 5 to 10 years, that will retire under the money match benefit, to accumulate and cash in their unused sick leave. The City of Portland currently has a balance of $41.7 million of unused sick leave on the books. If the city had to pay just, say, 10% of that liability to Aviva next year, the city would have to budget an additional $4.17 million. The actual cost could be even greater and would not be known until all employees made their election. The bill would reduce the maximum threshold that an employee must retain in terms of sick leave each year for the next 6 years, thereby freeing up more unused sick leave each year and potentially increasing the cost. The same cost that we would feel as the City of Portland would be felt by all public employers across the state that entered a VIBA program. The city urges you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
I have a question for you. Because Portland Police Association does have a VIBA account, but we also have people who are in PERS who are part of that association. How was that handled?
Senator Morissette, Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis, as I understand it, the PPCOA and the PPA both have VIBAs. Members of the collective bargaining units that are also members of the FPDNR are only the members that are allowed to participate in the VIBA, primarily because part of the agreement with both of those organizations is that they get to retain and cash in their unused sick leave in a formula that's been established within the Charter of the City of Portland.
I wonder if the city would have a position if and I'm getting to the contract issues, I'm kind of bridging into the general government committee, but because I do see a benefit to some of the bargaining units to say that the VIBA account might be something that their membership would be interested in, but I also agree there would have to be some offsetting reduction in the pension. And I'm not sure if we, as we talk about this, if we want to look at reaching back into existing populations or we look at it with respect to the successor system that we're now in the process of creating. I mean, if you could neutralize the fiscal, do you think your city would have a problem with that or opposition to it?
Chair Morissette, Senator Minnis. Given the fact that we have already reached accommodation with both those two unions that I previously spoke to, I believe that the city would likes VIBAs. I don't see that there's a problem with that. So we would, if there is a way to fund it that did not create a large fiscal impact for the city, yes, we would be supportive of a VIBA.
Yeah. Good. Actually, Mr. Chairman, I actually thought that this might be an interesting way to overcome some of the contract law issues that we were facing, because when you do have the entire organization, a union membership voting in favor of a particular offset or a benefit, if it was constructed statutorily that they could do this and the union subsequently voted for it and you had that offset, then I think that would meet the test for the contract law issues. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Shelley Honeywell, you were here to answer questions. Did you want to add anything to the conversation? Identify yourself, please.
Yes. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Shelley Honeywell. For the record, I'm also with the Department of Administrative Services. I am here to answer any questions on the fiscal impact, if there are any. One of the points I would like to clarify is that on the sick leave component, sick leave for state employees also is not a liability, meaning that if an employee does terminate, then sick leave is not paid out. So this would be an additional benefit, and that's why the fiscal looks the way it does.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 669 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 806.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 806 requires individual or group health insurance policies to pay for services rendered by professional counselors or marriage and family therapists acting within their scope of practice if policies provide payments or reimbursements for services by other professionals providing the same or similar services.
Glenn Maynard, would you come up, please? Yes. Would you identify yourself, please?
Yes, I'm Glenn Maynard. I'm president of the Oregon Mental Health Counselors Association. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here today on behalf of the Oregon Mental Health Counselors Association to support Senate Bill 806, which would add licensed professional counselors to the list of mental health professionals that group health plans are required to reimburse for care provided to their insureds. The current statutes exist as a result of the legislature's desire to ensure that the citizens of Oregon have access to mental health and chemical dependency treatment through their group health plan. The statute was enacted prior to the existence of licensing of professional counselors in Oregon, which accounts for licensed professional counselors not being included in the original statute. Senate Bill 806 updates current statutes to reflect the intent of previous legislatures by including professional counselors and marriage and family therapists in the array of licensed mental health professionals in Oregon and ensuring that consumers in Oregon have access to those professionals through their group health insurance. The primary importance of Senate Bill 806 is that it will provide the citizens of Oregon increased access to mental health and chemical dependency services through group health insurance. This will be accomplished by updating the existing mandated provider reimbursement statutes to reflect the addition of two groups of mental health professionals who have been licensed to practice in Oregon since 1990. Licensed professional counselors are included as providers by the 10 largest national managed behavioral health care companies, as well as many managed care companies in Oregon. Unfortunately, not all insurance companies and plans in Oregon have followed this trend. Although insurance companies can voluntarily add licensed professional counselors to their plans as providers, some have not done so. Some companies have included licensed professional counselors as providers on some plans, but not all plans. The result is that consumers are not allowed to see their provider of choice. At times, this occurs during the course of treatment when a consumer's insurance changes as a result of changes in employee benefits or a job change. This causes disruption to their treatment by starting over with a new provider or forces them to bear the financial burden of paying for the entire cost of care. At times, consumers are forced to travel outside of their community to access care because the local provider is a licensed professional counselor and may not be included on a particular health plan. Other health care providers are also prevented from referring to the provider who they feel is the most appropriate to provide care for the patient because licensed professional counselors may not be included on a health plan. While the addition of licensed professional counselors to the existing list of mandated mental health provider reimbursement will increase access to mental health and chemical dependency services for the citizens of Oregon, it will have a negligible impact on the cost of mental health care and health insurance premiums. A 2002 actuarial study commissioned by the American Mental Health Counselors Association demonstrated the cost of including licensed professional counselors to the Medicare program to be less than 1% over 5 years. A 1991 study by the Texas Insurance Department showed that the cost of mental health care increased by 1% as a result of including licensed professional counselors on the list of providers insurance companies were required to reimburse for mental health care in the state of Texas. Professional counselors have been licensed in Oregon since 1990. We work as clinicians in a wide variety of mental health settings. These include community mental health programs, alcohol and drug treatment programs, hospitals, emergency rooms, crisis centers, and private practice. We serve as clinicians, clinical supervisors, and agency administrators. As supervisors and administrators, we are responsible for overseeing the clinical work of other mental health professionals, including licensed clinical social workers, psychiatric nurses, psychiatric nurse practitioners, and psychologists and psychiatrists. Licensed professional counselors are required to have a master's degree in counseling, which meets the education requirement established by the Board of Licensed Counselors and Therapists, pass a national counselor exam, and have at least 2,400 hours of post-master's supervised clinical experience. I have included to the appendices of my testimony a comparison of the clinical training and experience of licensed professional counselors, licensed marriage and family therapists, licensed clinical social workers, and psychologists. I've also included a recent study comparing the clinical training of licensed professional counselors, licensed marriage and family therapists, licensed clinical social workers, and psychologists. These documents substantiate the clinical training and preparation to provide counseling for mental health and chemical problems is comparable between these groups. Oregon revised statutes define professional counseling as, quote, counseling services provided to individuals, couples, families, children, groups, organizations, or the general public through the therapeutic relationship, developing understanding of personal problems, defining goals, and planning action reflecting interests, abilities, aptitudes, and needs as these relate to problems and concerns in personal, social, and educational rehabilitation and career adjustment. Professional counseling includes, but is not limited to, application of counseling theories and techniques designed to assist clients with current or potential problems and to facilitate change in thinking, feeling, and behaving. The Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists has further defined application of counseling theories to mean application of counseling theories and techniques may include diagnostic, appraisal, and assessment. These definitions are consistent with the role licensed professional counselors have taken in the provision of mental health and chemical dependency treatment in Oregon. This role has been affirmed in administrative law proceedings. In summary, we feel that this bill will provide increased access to high-quality mental health and chemical dependency treatment for the citizens of Oregon. This will be accomplished without establishing new mandates and with essentially no increase in the cost of mental health care or health insurance premiums. We urge your passage of this legislation.
Questions? Thank you for the material.
You're welcome.
Dan Manilow. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but and John Miller.
John Mahalo.
Mahalo. Okay.
Close enough.
Don Mahalo, please.
Okay.
And John Miller, please. John Miller. We'll take both of you. Thank you. If you have written testimony,
Fine.
Go ahead. Now, let me just stop for a second. We are kind of on an abbreviated schedule. We have another bill to hear after this. There are a lot of there. We'll try to get most of the people who signed up to testify, but if you can keep it fairly brief, that would be good. If you do have written testimony, you don't get a chance to testify, we would appreciate your written testimony.
I'll be very
Don Mahalo.
Yeah. Senators, appreciate the opportunity. I'll be very brief in bullet form because I know the time is limited. I'd like to, the passage of this would eliminate public confusion as to who's licensed, who's not, who's covered, who's not. Mm-hmm. The general public comes to whomever they think they've been referred to, and they assume that we're all covered. As a matter of fact, the LPCs and the MFTs have not been, and as I've been meaning to mention, people then have to go elsewhere when they've been referred to you or have been already working with you. The second main point is supporting the marriage family or the LPC, especially the marriage family, in the direction of parity. That is to say, the training is quite similar in looking over curricula of PhDs, MSWs, and the MA degrees and MS degrees. They are all becoming rather similar. The notion of parity helps the people of the state realize that the government is willing to support marriages and families by supporting marriage and family therapists. Many LPCs also do what we call marriage systems work. The basic notion from our perspective, from my personal perspective, is that all therapy is family therapy. That is to say, our clients come into our offices coming from families, and unless there's an awareness of family systems processes, people not trained in that are apt to miss certain points that they would not otherwise. The MFT and LPC programs emphasize the issue of family systems, not just individual psychopathology. Let's see. One of the issues that comes up is that keeping MFTs and LPCs out of this vendorship borders on restraint of free trade, because the training is similar, the licensing is similar, the supervision is similar, the requirements are quite similar, but because, as Mr. Maynard mentioned, we came into existence after the original protocols were established, we're not in that in that vendorship role. It also amounts to restraint of personal choice for clients, and it seems to make no sense. There seems to be no cost to government. There is no cost to the insurance companies, because at any moment in time, the therapeutic community, those people seeking therapy, are going to go somewhere. So it's not like they're paying out more money. They will simply go to other licensed professionals who, in fact, in most cases, charge less than psychiatry and psychologists. But there is a benefit to the client because they have more choice. There is a benefit to the LPC MFT providers because it does benefit our income. There is a cost to existing vendored providers in the sense that there'll be more people moving into the therapeutic pie. So the MSWs, the PhDs, psychiatrists, so forth, would probably bear the most brunt of this. The real winner is the citizens of our state who get the message that marriage and family are important entities and that there are trained, licensed providers to support their efforts. That's all I need to say at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Okay. Dr. John Miller. I'm the president of the Oregon Association for Marriage and Family Therapy and also a teacher of family therapy at the University of Oregon. I'll be brief. I've submitted a document in the packet that you received with a write-up of this. We are in support of Senate Bill 806. One area that I'd like to address, I agree with all my colleagues here and the points that they have mentioned. One that I would add is that probably an issue of relevance to you is the cost of this kind of legislation. In 1999, the Surgeon General of the United States produced a report. It was the first ever report on mental health in the country. I'd just like to highlight that for a second, because one finding of the report was that the fragmented clinical delivery system and the difficulties of clients to overcome the barriers to services, getting into actual services, was one of the reasons that although there are validated mental health treatments, including family therapy and counseling, for most mental disorders, the folks who would benefit from them fail to seek them out because it's a difficult system to get into. Issues like this are one reason why it's difficult to get into it. If we're not on the vendor list, then it's difficult for them to get the services and have them paid for. I think in a way that probably in the past, I would guess, opposition to this kind of thing has been because of the fear that it would cost more money, and I would like to challenge that a bit. According to the Surgeon General's report, which was put on by the National Institute of Mental Health and Harvard and so on, and is a very research study, we spend nationally $79 billion a year as a result of the ancillary costs of untreated mental illness issues. We save a nickel, perhaps, by not passing this legislation and spend a lot more down the road, $79 billion a year nationally, in the most conservative effort in this research report. So I'd like to highlight that. I think that is certainly true of Oregon as well, on a more local level. All these treatments that these service providers provide are empirically validated. I've included a number of reports in my appendices here of research studies, and we can provide stacks of information about that. I think fundamentally this is an issue of consumer rights. I think providing more services is not more expensive, but typically it will save money down the road. Other issues I think that are relevant are that there's a, as Dr. Mahalo mentioned, there's this keeps family therapists and licensed professional counselors out of what would otherwise be a market that where they could provide some help. So as a profession, I think it's time for this sort of thing to be come into place. I think that's about it for now. Thank you for allowing us.
Now, the document that we were handed at the beginning of the Dr. Maynard had it out, does that have the appendix that you were talking about?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, John Powell, Leonard Hagen, and... Peggy Annette, would you please come up? And we're trying to... because we do have another hearing that we have to get through before the end of...
We will be done before that second hand gets to the 12.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Hagen is with me. Manager of Government Affairs for Regents, and we've handed in written testimony. Indeed, that testimony will provide you with cost figures from actuaries on this issue, and also discusses a few other issues. It would have a cost benefit to the PEB plan, and we just would let you have your the written testimony.
It has a cost.
Mr. Chairman, this mandate would affect the
PEB plan. Yeah, okay. I thought you said a cost benefit.
Cost increase. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leonard Hagan. John has introduced me. I'm with the Regents. You have the written testimony. I will be very brief. We've heard from prior testimony already today. One gentleman mentioned we are in a health care crisis. This committee has heard that before. And when I talk about a health care crisis, I mean from a cost perspective. It's the position of Regents that we oppose any mandate that is going to increase the cost of health care and benefits to our members. I believe Mr. Maynard mentioned that it may be a close to a 1% increase. That's consistent with what we've received from our actuaries, basing their methodology on nationally used methodologies by Milliman. We came up with a 1% increase that for Regents alone, that would be roughly $14 million that our members would have to absorb by way of increased premiums. The second point that I'll briefly mention is that this bill only affects roughly 30% of the population here in Oregon. It only applies to the commercial insurance products. It does not apply to government programs, Medicare, Medicaid, the Oregon Health Plan. That makes up approximately 30% of the population. Self-insured employers, it does not attach or address self-insured employers, those employers that can self-insure, and because of ERISA preemption, this bill would not address the members under self-insured programs, nor the uninsured. Those that can't afford insurance now, roughly 10%. I heard previous testimony that it's up around 25%. You can see these are imprecise numbers, but it's certainly a problem here in Oregon.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America, and I will make just two brief comments. One of the key issues associated with this bill that is somewhat problematic for the insurance reimbursement is that insurance reimbursement is paid for services that are medically necessary, and the individuals or the practitioners affected by this bill do not have the ability to do medical diagnoses within their scope of practice, and it creates an issue for us in that assumably this issue is skirted, and so absent their ability to do this diagnosis, then there is a problem that would continue regarding their reimbursement. They presently can operate under the direction of additional or other licensed professionals, such as a psychologist or a licensed clinical social worker. I think you'll hear more about that. But that has been the heart of this discussion that has been before the legislature for at least the last two or three sessions that I can recall. The other technical comment that I would make is that there, the language that deals with reimbursement for these practitioners is somewhat unclear in terms of how it would apply. It appears to require reimbursement under a fee schedule set by region for these folks, and that may have been applicable, you know, some years ago when we were operating under more of an indemnity style insurance system, but it is not that common these days. And with that, I would answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
They're like herding cats. I couldn't get them out quite as fast as I wanted.
Good job. Thank you. Damiana, would you please come up? And John Dial? Damiana, you go first.
Chair Marsette, members of the committee, I also will be very brief. I've submitted some written testimony on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association, who is in opposition to this bill. The main opposition is that the same that they've had when this issue has come up in the past, that we believe this is an expansion of the scope of practice beyond the licensure. And the Oregon Psychological Association has offered to assist the professional counselors and the therapists if they would like to modify the scope of their license to allow them to diagnose and treat mental and emotional disorders. We think that would be an appropriate way to allow them to be reimbursed as a qualified provider.
Thank you, Damian.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me today. I'm John Deal, and I am the former chair of the licensing board, and I'm here representing both bodies. I'm in favor of this bill. I want to start.
I'm sorry. I want to hear all of it.
Okay.
Could you start over?
Absolutely. My name is John Deal. I'm the former chair of the licensing board and a former board member, and I'm here today both as a licensed clinical social worker and a licensed marriage and family therapist. So, to that extent, I don't have an axe to grind because I can get reimbursed anyway because of the license I have as a clinical social worker. What I think is a real critical issue here is the opportunity for your constituency to have some choices regarding mental health services. And that's restricted now for those individuals who want to take advantage of the mental health benefit provided by their health insurance plan. Some people don't have that benefit as part of their health insurance plan. It's not mandated now. It may be there's another Senate bill you're familiar with that you guys will be discussing. That's one thing I wanted to say. Secondly, it's come up a couple of times about people practicing outside the scope of practice. As an LCSW, or licensed clinical social worker, it's in statutory language that I can diagnose and treat. As an LMFT, it's not in the language that I can diagnose and treat. But what I can say, having been a person on the board, is that the requirements academically to become licensed in this state are comparable to that of a social worker, and I think you heard that mentioned earlier. And I have before me something I would share with you. I got it just recently. The Regulatory Board for Marriage and Family Therapy contracts with a professional educational service, and in their exam requirements, they have an entire section of the exam that all LMFTs have to take on assessment and diagnosis. So that's covered in terms of the exam. An additional part of the exam, it's designing and conducting treatment. So this issue of diagnosis and treatment has been brought up before, but I don't think there's a basis at this point in time to argue that people who are LPCs or LMFTs, because they've taken this necessary exam. And as someone who practices with both licenses, I can say to you that people that are practicing under their LMFT or LPC license actually can meet that competency. And I guess I want to just reiterate my final point, and then I'll be finished. And that is, I think the main issue here is to enable the public and your constituency to have a choice of services. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have a question, John. Why wouldn't people just get a master's in social work or become a licensed clinical social worker?
Well, because the disciplines are somewhat different. It's a little bit out of the scope of our conversation, but...
Well, you're the one that raised the issue.
Okay, I'd be glad to address it. People that go into social work do so for two reasons. One, because they can get licensure.
Right.
The other, because the scope of practice tends to, in some instances, be not only systemic, but kind of community-based. So people that go into social work often are doing it because they want to work in hospital settings, they want to work in community-based settings, whereby they're enabled enabling their clients through a variety of psychosocial interventions to become more functioning. And
okay, but again, I don't. Can you tell me why wouldn't you become a licensed clinical social worker? Well, you can still do marriage counseling, can't you?
Sure.
And get reimbursed.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Well, I think Portland State would probably agree with you.
Yeah. Actually, Mr. Chairman, one of the worst family beefs I ever arbitrated, by the way, is uniform policemen. People throwing stuff out the window, breaking furniture, yelling and screaming. Been gone on for minutes. I asked them, I said, what do you do for a living? They were both relaxation therapists.
Well,
I always thought that was a little odd. The futon's out the door.
And nothing to relax on anymore. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have three other individuals, and I will call you to come up, but you've got to just tell us where you stand, and without getting a lot into detail. Lisa, yes. Lisa Tressel. There's a name. Okay, Todd York. You signed up late, but come on up and give us a very brief statement. And B-I-L-Y or Z or something. Is there another person who signed up whose name? Ah! There you go. I'll be anxious to hear what your name is. We have another hearing that will take probably half an hour, and we're going to go over, so I just need a very brief statement from you to tell us where you are. And I know where you are, Lisa, so forget it.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries. And just to be brief, we are opposed. We're very concerned about adding any new cost into the health care arena when we are struggling to control costs. And this would definitely add cost to my members.
Okay, good. Thank you, Lisa.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Todd York. For the record, I'm an independent insurance agent here in Salem. I represent about 65 small business people. If they were in this room, what they'd tell you is they're breaking under the strain of 15 to 20% rate increases. There's no doubt in my mind that this bill would increase that. If they were here, they would say in one voice that they'd be against it. That's the abbreviated version.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Bruce Strati. My handwriting is not very good.
That's okay, Bruce.
I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Lutheran Community Services Northwest. We have offices throughout the state, including two areas where we actually are the mental health authority. And we employ clinical social workers, marriage and family therapists, and licensed professional therapists. And I can assure you that all of these people are responsible for diagnosing problems, for developing a treatment plan, and for providing therapy. And this is consistent with the qualified mental health professional regulations and administrative rules for Medicaid. And they do this consistently. I can also assure you that one of the issues that we face consistently, particularly in the rural areas, is that people do not have much choice, and we have difficulty attracting therapists into those areas because it's really not very productive for them to come into those places. And we would welcome the fact that if this bill were approved, there would be much more opportunities for these people to come into those areas and provide needed services to hurting people. Thank you.
That's good comments. Good. Thank you very much. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 806, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 814.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 814 permits counties to provide 180 days court-ordered assisted outpatient treatment to people with serious mental illness.
Okay,
and in your packet, you do have two pieces of testimony, one from David Oakes and another from William Shiv.
Okay. Senator Devlin, would you come up, please? Okay. 814 fiscal. I don't know. Senator, did you want to bring Kathy? Did you have people that you wanted to bring with you?
Mr. Chairman, I actually will probably give relatively short testimony, and they will give the bulk of the testimony.
Okay.
And it might be better actually for me to speak first and then bring them up.
Good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Senator Richard Devlin from Senate District 19. I want to thank the chairman and the members of this committee for hearing this bill here today. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 814. Senate Bill 814 addresses a very serious problem that we have in Oregon concerning our inability to mandate outpatient mental health care. In Oregon, a high-risk mentally ill person may refuse outpatient treatment despite strong indications of progressive mental illness. Individuals must deteriorate to the point where they face involuntary commitment before we provide any mandate for treatment. This mandate, our involuntary commitment laws, require that an individual must be classified as an imminent danger to themselves or others before they can be involuntarily treated. I think actually that Senator Minnis is very familiar with this area of law and familiar with the controversies surrounding it. Senate Bill 814 addresses this problem and helps to ensure that proper treatment is received. This bill creates court-ordered assisted outpatient care. modeled after California Laura's Law, enacted in September 2002. A similar law was also enacted in New York, Kendra's Law, in 1999. Assisted outpatient care in Oregon would be carried out through treatment plans and case management at a voluntary county level for severely mentally ill individuals, initially for a treatment period of up to 180 days. Safeguards for mentally ill individuals will include requiring a history of medical noncompliance, prior release from hospital, prison, or jail, or attempted serious violent acts, serious prospects of risk to him or herself or others, and to prevent relapse and deterioration. Assistant outpatient treatment is meant to benefit mentally ill individuals who need ongoing psychiatric care and support to prevent dangerous relapse and recidivism, but who are reluctant to have difficulty seeking and following through with community-based treatment. Oregon currently has no assisted outpatient care. This mental health bill would introduce this level of care and ultimately reduce homelessness, hospitalization, and involvement in the criminal justice system in the counties that participate. Senate Bill 814 would help end the cycle of hospitalization, the reoccurrence of quitting treatment and relapse, as well as make it easier for families to recommend outpatient treatment for family members with serious mental illness when that particular person does not have the capacity to accept or assess his or her own need for care. I believe we have a serious problem in this state. People are not receiving the necessary and care treatment that they need. The goal of this bill is not to force people into treatment, not to infringe upon their civil rights, but to ensure that care is available to those who have a record that shows the need for such treatment. Given, however, the economic realities of this particular session, I am well aware that the implementation of a bill of this magnitude is improbable at this time. My clear hope in this hearing is that this sort of brief overview of this issue will give enough impetus to members of this committee that ultimately this issue can be discussed in some detail in an appropriate interim committee that can devote the time which I believe it deserves. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity. Here with me today is Judith Potosny and Kathy Chin, constituents of mine. Early in this session, Judith and Kathy presented me with this issue problem, presented me with this possible solution, and have gone to incredible lengths to push this bill and very important concept forward. I particularly wanted them to have an opportunity to testify in this particular session because I think that the message that they give is a very clear and compelling one. I know that this bill carries with it some controversy, as these mental health issues always seem to. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I would close, and I think that they might be the best ones to answer questions also.
Thank you very much, Senator. I appreciate your testimony. Kathy and Judith, would you please come up and identify yourselves and give us this information?
Senator Morissette, members of the Senate Health Policy Committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to have this hearing. For the record, I am Judith Wu Putas, and with my sister Kathy Chin of Lake Oswego, we're here also with our father, Gene Wu of Portland, and our brother, John Wu, and his wife, Sherry of Beaverton. We appear today in support of Senate Bill 814, Assisted Outpatient Treatment, or AOT, which is patterned after Laura's Law in California and Kendra's Law in New York. We are submitting written testimony, as well as attaching a copy of a report called Kendra's Law, an interim report on the status of assisted outpatient treatment, which was issued by the New York State Office of Mental Health on January 1st, 2003. This is 3 years after the enactment of Kendra's Law in New York. We'd like to share our personal family history because this is what has led us here today. Our sister suffers from very serious mental illness and would benefit from the passage and support of Senate Bill 814. Our family has resided in Portland area for over 50 years. Our sister now is in her 40s. She was born in Portland, has lived in Portland almost all of her life. She earned a bachelor's degree in economics, was employed by by one of the largest health insurance companies as a senior underwriter. She rose to that position after 10 years before she became ill in the late 1980s. For almost 15 years, she has become more acutely psychotic. She hears voices. She's deeply depressed. She exhibits wild anger and suffers from paranoia. She has been under the care of a psychiatrist for almost 10 years, but refuses to take prescribed antipsychotic medications because she does not believe she's mentally ill. In the past 5 years, her life has deteriorated due to her increasingly bizarre mood swings. Her marriage has failed. She lost custody of her only child, with whom she disappeared for 2 weeks last week without warning. I'm sorry, 2 weeks last year without warning. She's jobless. She's lost and spent all of her life in IRA savings. She's now heavily in debt with no source of income and is now homeless since January. We fear every day that her acute psychosis, lack of judgment, and deteriorating living situation places her at great risk of harm. For years, we have discussed her situation, our sister's mental illness, and the civil commitment process with the Multnomah County Department of Mental Health, trying to seek assistance for her. There is little the family or the county can do under the current civil commitment laws until she is in imminent danger to herself or to others. And when this occurs, it may really be too late. This is the reason why we support Senate Bill 814. Senator Devlin went into very great detail, and I don't think I really want to reiterate that. We submitted as an attachment the New York report because it's quite comprehensive. It discusses the benefits and the results of assisted outpatient treatment in that state for the past 3 years. And the results, I'll just summarize the results because they are quite striking. As documented by the New York Interim Report, Kendra's Law has dramatically reduced psychiatric hospitalizations from 87% to 20%. Homelessness from 21% to 3%, arrest from 30% to 5%, and incarcerations from 21% to 3%, and for approximately 2,500 high-risk, high-need consumers with serious mental illnesses living in New York City and in 8 New York counties. We believe that Senate Bill 814 will allow Oregon to provide community-based assisted outpatient treatment services for consumers such as our sister while she is rapidly deteriorating, and I would add her life is disintegrating before us, but she's still able to live out in the community. And that's what we'd like. We believe that Senate Bill 814 will allow Oregon to reduce costs for hospitalization of civilly committed consumers at state psychiatric hospitals, which had an average cost of $352 per day in 2001. Finally, we believe that Senate Bill 814 will allow Oregon to treat rather than to incarcerate the mentally ill at the Oregon Department of Correction facilities. Based on best guess, approximately 1,100 mentally ill inmates are incarcerated in state corrections facilities, in which Oregon spends approximately $25 million per year. Therefore, Senator Morissette, members of the Senate Health Policy Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'd be available with my sister to answer any questions. Yes.
Thank you. Were you?
No.
Oh, okay. As a health policy committee, I think this is a policy issue that needs to be considered. I think Senator Devlin touched on the issue earlier that with our there would be some cost involved. This is a complicated program. I do notice there is a constitutional challenge in the state of New York that is on, still in the process. So there are things that need to be worked out. But the summary and this, you know, the statistical outcome of what they've been doing is, I think, impressive. And I just think it's very important to look at this and to try to find if we can move it in our state. And I think that's something that I would recommend to an interim committee to do, because we are a policy committee, and I think we need to consider things that will help us save money in the long run, and besides, most importantly, help the people that need help. But I would like to have Gina Furman come up briefly.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So a couple of comments. The Senate Judiciary Committee in the 2001 session reviewed many of the same issues that you're seeing inherent in this bill and chose not to move forward with it because of the complexity of the constitutional issues at that time. So I agree with you that this ought to be perhaps flagged as an interim study. I know Mr. Junta testified back in 2001 regarding some of these issues that it really runs afoul of some long, long, long history, legal history over the Macnaughton rule, and, you know, when you can be deemed insane and when you can be, you know, I guess subjected to deprivation of your liberties and under the guise of mental health issues and so on and so forth. It's extremely complex and way beyond me, but I agree with the chair. I think this is an issue that probably should be deferred to a serious interim study because the legal issues are so, so complex.
I know.
Senator Morissette, yeah. Senator Minnis, as an attachment to the interim report, there is a summary of the cases in New York which are challenging Kendra's law. Mm-hmm. And it's attached as part of the interim report, just for your information.
I saw that.
Thank you.
Yeah. One quick question.
Yes.
Your relative, was that person involved in criminal conduct?
It's a matter of definition.
Well, I mean, the person was convicted, and
there was not a conviction.
No, okay, Mr. Chairman, that's one of the areas where you do find it. This gap is where a person has not entered the criminal justice system. The court isn't able to compel the person into some form of treatment.
I see.
So this is a person who's not necessarily a clear danger to themselves or others in the sense of a total crisis in their emotional stability. It's someone who's really somewhat stable but is deteriorating and is becoming more of a problem. And that's it's a kind of gap area that's very, very hard to determine and very hard to diagnose.
Correct. Yes. Okay.
Gina, would you like to?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here.
Chair Morissette, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman, and I am the director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. At this time, the mental health program directors are opposed to this bill. I personally have great empathy for the family that just spoke, and many of us in this room have similar situations at home that we're dealing with. Our concerns are the constitutional ones that Senator Minnis raised, and I was actually excited to hear Senator Devlin talk about perhaps addressing these in an interim committee. And Senate Bill 541 and 146 that we talked about, perhaps something like this could be put in, something like that for discussion. I understand what they're trying to get at. There are some constitutional issues, and the costs at this time are prohibitive because, as you know, the mental health system has just been almost dismantled fiscally.
Questions?
And that's not to mention the impact on the court system, too.
Correct.
This would require an additional court hearing, and we're already shut down on Fridays, so
yes.
It's problematic.
Bob Joseph?
Junda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junda. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. We're opposed to this bill. However, I would like to, for many of the reasons that have been stated, I would like to say that I'd like to thank Senator Devlin for bringing this issue to you. and the problem that you heard is a real problem. I think the question is how it can be addressed and effectively addressed. And the more study, the better on that.
Okay. Thank you. Now, I'm going to end the public hearing, but I do, there are Bob Martin, Jim McLeod, if you'd like to come up. You have testimony that you can submit in writing if you'd just like to come up and briefly tell us what your feeling is and then your opinion and then submit your testimony. Jim McLeod, Bob Martin is here.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name's Bob Martin. I'm with the Oregon chapter of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. And we're an international watchdog organization that investigates and exposes psychiatric violations of human rights. And we're adamantly opposed to this. We consider it a forced drugging bill. And make no mistake, this is an assisted outpatient treatment of forced drugging. And one of our main concerns on this is that diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders is the one that's used in this. And this particular manual has over 375 so-called mental disorders, some of them such as disorder of written expression, or mathematics disorder, or how many of us have suffered a caffeine-related disorder. So that's a big concern of ours. We feel that individuals should be given full physicals and see medical doctors and make sure that the mental that they haven't this medical problem is or mental health problem is not a medical problem. And if you look at my testimony here, there is actually an instance here. It says one such case is of a woman who was wrongly diagnosed with mental illness. She began rather abruptly hearing voices in her head. This progressed to an inability to talk, and she finally couldn't even take care of herself. Doctor after doctor simply pronounced her schizophrenic. Finally, a medical doctor conducted an extensive medical search and recommended two tests be done. These revealed astronomically high levels of citric acid, high levels of lactic acid, and unusually low levels of other substance in the urine, indicating a deficiency of a compound that affects glucose metabolism. Now, glucose metabolism is key to mental energy. IV drips were started, and jumping to the end of the story, she completely recovered, shows no signs of lingering trace of her former mental state. Now, this took 6 weeks versus someone that's being caught up in the mental health system for the rest of their lives because they're on the drugs. So we would appreciate it if you take a look at this. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, would you?
Yes. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Jim McLeod. I'm the manager with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 814. This bill is a complicated bill that would establish the authority of a court to order a person to obtain assisted outpatient treatment, and the department does have a number of concerns about the bill and the impact that it would have on persons with mental illness as well as on counties that provide services. The court-ordered assisted outpatient treatment would place restrictions on the rights of mentally ill persons who are not at imminent risk of harm to themselves or others and who do not meet existing criteria to be civilly committed. The bill also includes provisions that we're concerned about whereby persons could be taken into custody for 72 hours if the person refused to be examined. So there are some civil liberty issues we're concerned about. These are coercive provisions that represent some erosion to civil rights for persons with mental illnesses. And there are already provisions in law for persons with mental illness to be civilly committed if they do present a risk of harm to themselves or others or if they're unable to care for themselves due to mental illness and treatment. The provisions which include hospitalizations, prior hospitalizations, is one of the criteria under which a person could be court-ordered to receive assisted outpatient treatment could create a disincentive for individuals to seek voluntary hospitalization if they felt that that could be used against them at some future date. And that could lead to an increase in civil commitment proceedings and involuntary hospitalizations if their conditions did deteriorate from that. The bill also allows counties to choose whether to provide court-ordered assisted outpatient treatment. Counties that choose to provide such treatment will incur higher case management costs due to the limitations on caseload size that would be imposed with the bill. It refers to a caseload size of 8, which is substantially smaller than we see throughout the state currently. The costs for counties to develop and implement court-ordered assisted outpatient treatment are not included in the governor's balanced budget. The funds for outpatient treatment generally were cut as a result of the fifth special session, and therefore funds will need to be appropriated for treatment and case management if this bill were to be implemented. It is also likely that many counties will choose not to participate, and consequently the court-ordered assisted outpatient treatment process would be implemented inconsistently across the state. Passage of the bill would require the department to implement training and certification of persons who conduct investigations for the courts. The department would also need to establish methods for monitoring implementation of this program, and because these activities are not included in the governor's balanced budget, the additional workload would need to be absorbed by existing staff, and local courts would also experience an increase in workload due to implementation of the bill. Given these concerns, the department opposes the Senate Bill 814. Thank you.
Thank you. We will close with Gene Wu and John Wu. Would you please come up? Do you have written testimony?
Chair Morissette, I do not. I just want to comment briefly.
Absolutely.
My name is John Wu. I happen to be the brother of my two illustrious sisters who presented testimony earlier. What I wanted to say very simply is this. I do support the Senate Bill 814. Mm-hmm. I commend the committee's position of referring it to an interim committee, possibly for future study. Having experienced this with my sister through these years and with my mother before, who was, by the way, treated medically, and who ended up having a very productive life until her passing 3 years ago. Okay. The only question I ask is this. Typically, individuals who have a problem, whether it's substance, whether it's medical, whether it's mental, they're usually the last ones to admit it. If they never admit it, then who helps the needy? Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 814, and we will adjourn the session. Yeah, we got through.
Amazing.
Well, I hate to end on a